Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our Morning Talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producer for the program, Harriet Williamson, Jason Croft, is at the controls this hour, and Kyle Mabry was on for hour number one. Animals have been an essential part of human culture for a very long time. We humans, in fact, have had this long tendency to define ourselves by stressing the differences that we saw between us and them. In recent years, though, there are a growing number of scholars who've begun to look more closely at what it is that we have in common with other animals, with really, though, the same goal, that is the goal of helping us to think about what it is that makes us human. In this hour of the program, we'll be talking with Jane Desmond. She's professor of anthropology here at the University of Illinois. And we'll be talking a bit about what is something of an emerging field, something that's happening at many universities, and that is a field that generally is called animal studies. And what that means is going beyond the conventional approach toward thinking about animals that biologists and zoologists do, and bringing people from different disciplines into this conversation to think about and talk about this bond, this relationship between humans and animals, thinking a little bit more about what their experience of the world is, our experience of the world, and how those two things come together. I think it's quite an interesting subject area, and we will be talking about it in this part of the show. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. So at any point, if you have questions, comments, you would like to be involved in the conversation, you certainly should feel welcome to do that. The only thing that we ask is that people just try to be brief, just so we can keep things moving along. But questions, comments from anyone are certainly welcome. Thank you very much for being here.
My pleasure, David. I'm excited.
I appreciate it. I think that this is very interesting, and I here's why, I guess. I think that it says something really important, that we go beyond from the point that we were at with animals for such a long time, which was, I think, in humans, this preoccupation of saying, how are we different? Mm-hmm. And it was all about finding things that human beings did that animals didn't do. Well, it seems that every time we'd identify one of those things, sooner or later, research or observation would come along and knock that off the list and say, no, we can't count that anymore.
Absolutely.
So it becomes great, more and more of a struggle to find ways that we can say human beings are different. You know, the human animal is different from other animals. And I think that it says we're really starting to think much differently about non-human animals than we have in the past. How is that happening on university campuses?
This is such an exciting time to be doing work on animals, David, and actually I'm thrilled that you're having me on and giving me a chance to talk more broadly about this. As you know, last year I was able to organize through the university's Center for Advanced Studies a campus-wide initiative called Knowing Animals, Histories, Strategies, and Frontiers in Human-Animal Relationship, trying to look to the past and trying to imagine some new futures there. And you interviewed a number of our fabulous speakers, including Franz Duval and many other folks who came in. So it's wonderful to have this opportunity to follow up. Animal studies as an emergent discipline, as you've been saying, really is beginning to consolidate itself and institutionalize itself in universities, but it's just at the edge of doing that, which mm-hmm. is one reason why, as a scholar who's been doing this for the last 10 to 15 years, it's exciting, because it used to be pretty lonely out there. There were a few people, wonderful folks like the historian Harriet Ritvo and others who were doing very good work, but there wasn't a sort of critical mass of people across a number of disciplines beyond, of course, the specialist in biology and zoology, ethology, and of course, veterinary medicine. Their work is animals. But for those of us in the humanities, in the arts, in the social sciences who really want to formulate research questions about human-animal relationships as a part of social, intellectual, political, and economic history, this is just emerging. So now I have a lot of colleagues around the country and also in some other countries as well, especially in Europe and Australia, who are coming together to ask these questions. What are our relationships with animals? How have they changed? How might they change? And above all, why do they matter?
Mm. I think certainly one of the big changes that has happened is that for most people now, I think they don't really have a personal relationship with animals unless, of course, they live with a companion animal. And that, I think, has to have a profound impact on how people think about these questions or whether they think about them at all.
Well, I'm gonna contradict you there.
Oh, okay.
I think we do have personal relationships with animals, and that they are embedded in our lives, in actually every aspect of our lives. And you're right; we don't always note it like that unless they are our pets. We, for instance, what we're wearing, is it a wool shirt? What you had for dinner? I don't know what you had, but perhaps it was a chicken. Whether or not we call the Terminex guy when the critters move in and so forth, whether or not we hear the birds chattering as we walk down the street. So, in fact, we are in a world embedded with animal relations, even if you hit a raccoon crossing the street. What we don't do is necessarily think of those as relationships unless it is a pet. And as you mentioned, I have some great statistics here from the Argus Institute at Colorado State University Vet School that says now 63% of U.S. households have at least one pet. So we're in the majority now of having pet owner families, and that this one I especially liked: 50% of pet owners would prefer their pet as their only companion if they were stranded on a desert island. So that gives you something of the sort of sense of the specialness of our relationship with pets. But in animal studies, what we're trying to do is not only use that, and we start that as a very strong affective bond that we can reach students through, but then we want to open out to larger questions like, what happened if we tried to write the history of New York City without thinking about the horse and transportation, and so forth? So these are some of the ways that we look at really shifting the lens of social history to say, what happens if we put animals into those equations?
Yeah. I guess what I was thinking about is that for a lot of human history, that the relationship that people had with non-human animals was very utilitarian, although that's also one has to acknowledge that there are spiritual angles here, but essentially it was kind of utilitarian, and that although, as you point out, that's still there. And yes, I will admit I had some chicken last night for dinner, and you know I'm wearing leather shoes, and I do also have a cat living at my house. I'm not exactly sure what the relationship is exactly what the relationship is, but he lives. He's certainly not a piece of property, I'll tell you that much. So, you know, yes, in my life there are those things. I just wonder how maybe the point that I was getting is while those relationships exist, I think that I'm not sure how much we think about them. You know, I don't think about them a lot. And I wonder though whether we're moving toward the point where people are indeed thinking about those things in ways. And I'm not just talking about scholars. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about everybody thinking about those things in ways that they had not before. Whether there is some sort of whether there has been sort of some sort of break in the continuity between over time between this utilitarian kind of attitude and something else, and I'm not sure what.
It's a great way to put that question on the table. And I think when scholarly areas of concern emerge, they do so in a complex social and political environment of which scholars are part, but they're also, you know, not scholars every minute of their life. Sometimes they're just taking out the trash or walking the dog, and so are other people. And a lot of the shifts we're seeing now, as you said earlier on, in public discourse, have to do with these that shifting line. You know, used to be, well, humans made tools, and then we found out that Betty the Crow is bending the straw to get, you know, something to eat out of the bottle. So, okay, there goes the tool making. Then we thought, well, all right, what about only humans can count? After all, we invented calculus. And while animals aren't inventing calculus, we're finding now that they have a sense of number in a particular way through some experiments with parrots, for example. So that line of division saying, our mind, our way of being in the world is absolutely the only way that is special is something that has been overturned, and we're beginning to get a more capacious sense of what intelligence can be. And we see that especially in our growing relations with primates and cetaceans as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, that I'm interested in this move away from this preoccupation that we've had from a long time. Humans have been preoccupied with what makes us special.
Right.
And so that's why we're always grasping at this definition and say, is there something, some kind of behavior that human beings do that other animals don't do? And so we're starting to run out of things like that. If we're moving away from that, do you think in the popular imagination any move away from this human exceptionalism that has characterized our relationship with animals?
I think it's difficult to say. On the one hand, yes. On the other hand, we still see a lot of depictions of that, let's say, in popular culture. And I don't want to suggest, you know, for a minute that humans and non-human animals are exactly the same. Mm-hmm. But as we come to understand more of the ways in which we might be the same, I think it also becomes incumbent on us to try to understand better what their life in the world might be. And there we run into our own limitations. That's where the sort of thorny issue of anthropomorphism comes in.
Sure.
It seems to be okay when it's in cartoons when it's in children's stories like Charlotte's Web that I just found out in your bookcase when I was waiting. But also, can we use that in a way? That's how we know the world. We know the world through our own capacities. So the interpretation of what it might mean for animals to have very different senses, very different type of mental capabilities, that's something that I think is coming to the fore. There's a flip there that says, well, they can't speak our language, so they don't have a language. Some people are saying, "What? Don't we speak theirs? I mean, isn't it a very foreign language if in fact they have a system of communicative symbols that we might recognize as something that could be called a form of language?" And mm-hmm. that's a shift, I think.
Yeah. I do. It certainly is the case that this relationship, how we look at them, how we look at that relationship has been a part of how humans define themselves. And for a long time, I suppose it was an oppositional kind of thing. We were defining ourselves by saying we were not them. Mm-hmm. If we can't do that quite as much as we used to, though, is there still some way in which looking at animals, living with animals, thinking about them is going to continue to play a role in how we define ourselves?
Let's take the legal arena for a moment, because although I am not a lawyer or a law scholar, one of the great guests we had last year was Rebecca Huss from Valparaiso Law School, and she was one of the lawyers in the Michael Vick dogfighting case. Mm-hmm. There's a movement within law studies and the practice of law to struggle with the differences between humans and people, and to understand ways that we might articulate that difference in the law. For instance, some scholars are advocating for the category of living property, and living property would have incumbent upon the owners of that living property certain responsibilities. That's a good example of a move. And in some countries in Europe now, they're struggling with what to do in terms of legal responsibilities and rights in terms of humans over or towards or to primates. So primates are emerging as a special legal category towards which humans may decide that we have greater and specific responsibilities than, say, to snakes.
Hmm. Our guest in this hour of Focus is Jane Desmond. She is professor of anthropology, also is affiliated with the Department of Gender and Women's Studies at the University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign. She is interested in, among other things, this area of human-animal study. She's currently working on a book for the University of Chicago Press looking at human-animal relations. And as she mentioned, she was involved in putting together a series of talks that happened last year on the campus. And we had a number of folks here on this program to talk about this particular issue. And we want to talk about it a little bit more and shine some light on this interesting area here that involves scholars from different disciplines, so not just biologists and zoologists, thinking about animals and thinking about the relationship between us and non-human animals. And questions welcome. In fact, we have a couple of people who'd like to jump into the conversation. The number is 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And there's also email as well if you'd like to send us your thoughts that way, will-talk@illinois.edu. We have a couple of callers here ready to go, and we'll start with Urbana and line number one. Hello.
Professor Desmond, I apologize if David's already asked this or one of your callers, but is there any sign that non-human animals have any moral sense? And the two extreme examples I'll ask about are, do they, for example, ever welcome a stranger, an alien animal? Or secondly, do they ever love their enemies? Hmm. I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Thank you so much. For our caller from Urbana, that's a tough one, and it's a really wonderful question asking about whether any scholars are finding sense of a moral sense in animals. And I have to say, although this is not my specialty area, that some, including the biological anthropologist Barbara King, one of my colleagues who is at William & Mary, are looking at the question of whether animals might exhibit something we as humans could identify as empathy, not just, as you were saying earlier, David, the notion of a kind of utilitarian relationship, mm-hmm. in this case among themselves, mm-hmm. in terms of caretaking for each other, but a concern. We know that with elephants, there appear to be behaviors that we would interpret as mourning and sort of a circling around bones of a dead member of their herd and so forth. There's also some emergent research that some are interpreting as a sense of maybe we want to call it proto-justice among some primates, so that if one primate is getting a lot of rewards for doing something very simple and the other primate does the same sort of task and gets no reward, there's a sense in which that primate might even go on strike out of what those scientists are positing as possibly a sense of justice. And I'm trying to put quotation marks around all of these concepts and words because we can only use our social interpretive lens to interpret their behavior. We don't know if they experience this in a way that makes empathy an appropriate label. But for us, for some scientists, this is certainly a question that is emergent, and they're trying to figure out ways that we could understand it better.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's go to another call here. Gibson City, line number two. Hello.
You know, I've been around horses all my life, and I find, just like with humans, that they have all the various range of emotion. And so... And I've been very close to many horses.
Mm-hmm.
And so some are, and they are very close to each other. They're herd animals. And some are closer than others. Some are mean. Some are mm-hmm. very gentle.
Mm-hmm. So real individuals.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us a little more about this kind of range of emotion and how you would describe it in what you've seen? If our caller's still there?
Yes. Let's see. I've had a couple of horses, that did die.
Mm-hmm.
And the horses that were with them really grieved.
Yeah, I think we are seeing evidence, certainly in some mammals, of behavior that we can or that we do interpret as mourning, and that is a great example. I appreciate the caller from Gibson City. I actually really like Gibson City, too. I get up there to one of your restaurants as often as I can. But this range of emotion that he's describing and his notion of the horses as individuals is something that we experience with certainly with a lot of pets, but even more broadly, I think, with herd animals, or if someone's a farmer and they're raising cows and so forth, we can have a lot of anecdotal or ethnographic evidence that we can begin to accrue to try and understand these types of behaviors and whether or not, you know, should we label them emotion, and if so, what those might be.
Yeah. And they're very intelligent.
Well, thanks very much for telling us about that. It's great to hear about your personal relations.
Let me ask you this, because, you know, if you're trying to understand what an animal is feeling, you're trying to understand what they're thinking or if they think, you can't ask them. So what we're doing is we're observing.
Correct.
And we're looking at their behaviors. We're looking at how they interact with us. We're looking at how they interact with other animals. And we're trying to understand that by, you know, we see them doing something. For example, we have a group of animals and one of them dies. And so they exhibit behaviors that we would, if we saw human beings doing that, we would have a pretty good sense what was going on there. So what we're having to do is to generalize from our experience and try to look at what we see and see if any of that makes sense to us.
Right.
And put ourselves in that same situation and say, well, this is what I would be feeling, and this is what it would look like, and this is what the behavior would be like. And so we see the animals doing those things. So that's about all we can do. We try to generalize from our experience to try to figure out what's going on with them. But as you say, that can be dangerous to make that leap and to say, well, I know how I would feel in that situation, and they're in that situation. So can I say from that they are feeling what I would be feeling?
Right, right.
I mean, how do we do that? How do you try to get into the head of another animal when you can't ask them what's going on with them?
First, I'm going to say, David, sometimes you can ask them, because I want to talk about Coco and Kanzi. But in general, yes, and I think in our daily lives, you know, we do this sort of interpretation with animals we know well because we were familiar with their behavior. So if they're sort of not eating, lack of appetite, and they're lackluster, and they've just lost a companion, you know, another rabbit in their house or whatever, which happened with our rabbit recently, we would interpret that as a way of responding to a death in the family. But on the other hand, maybe they just have a stomach ache. We don't really know that. So there are ways that, as researchers, we try to control some situations and to get a little closer to a rigorous investigation of that. But there are, as you say, real limits. And I think the ultimate limit is an epistemological one, that is a theory of knowledge. How we know the world as humans is how we can know the world. I don't think there's real, you know, beyond that. That's the frameworks through which we come to interpret the world, and of course those change over time and across communities. So there is a limit there, and I don't think that's a bad thing. I mean, that's what we can do. And if we have a moment now, I do want to talk about the language possibility.
Sure.
I want to tell you a story. And this was when I got to meet Kanzi the bonobo, who is one of the very few human language-enabled apes in the world, and he's at the Great Ape Center in Des Moines, Iowa, and I used to teach at the University of Iowa, so some faculty colleagues and I were able to go over and meet Kanzi through his researcher caretaker, Sue Savage Rumba. And when you go to meet Kanzi, you're not shaking hands with him. He's behind a large glass partition. He's very strong. But you have to be introduced, and using a system of symbols on a pad, a lexigram, Sue will tell him, well, you know, the visitors are here. And so she said, well, Jane's here. So I said, Kanzi, can I take your picture? Because they had a rule you always had to ask. And he pointed to the symbol for no on his pad. And she said, oh, sorry, Jane. He says no. I said, okay. And then he said on his pad, want ball, pointed to two different symbols. She said, "Uh-oh, he wants a ball." I said, "Kanzi, we didn't bring a present. I'm sorry. Maybe we can send you a ball. We'll go back to Iowa City and send you a ball." And this was not satisfactory. So he pointed at these symbols again and said, "Want ball?" I said, okay. Look, as soon as we get home, I'll send you a ball. Really sorry. I should have thought to bring a present." And he looked right at me, and he pointed to his symbol board again and said, "Want ball now." And so that was the moment. I said, he's telling me he wants it now. He's understanding time. He knows what tomorrow means, and that's too far away. And so the four of us from the Center for Advanced Study there at Iowa, we got in the university van, and we drove to Toys R Us, and we decided, would he like a soccer ball or a baseball or a basketball? What should we do? So we brought a ball back to Kanzi, gave it to him, and he's happily playing with it. And about 10 minutes later, he goes over to Sue, and he points to some symbols again. And Sue said, "Oh, you know, Kanzi just said you could take his picture." I had not asked again. So there was some notion of reciprocity there. And when I got my camera ready, he perched on a chair and, you know, kind of posed in a very dramatic way. So that was, in some ways, a phenomenal life-altering experience. I had used my language. He had responded in a sort of version of that symbol system with a very specific communication of attitude, desire, and permission, ultimately, in the end, for that picture. So sometimes we can ask them.
That's a great story. I like the aspect of him saying to you, "Now, human, what part of want ball do you not understand?"
Right, you don't understand the now.
That's just it. One still wonders, though, really, what's going on in his head. Obviously, he's learned how to manipulate human beings to get what he wants.
I give him some credit for that and using language to do so. You know, that's one of the things we try to do. So I give him some credit for that.
All right. We have a couple more callers here. We'll need to take a very short break, then we'll have more of Focus.
On the HBO series The Wire, Sonia Sohn played a police detective in an East Baltimore neighborhood taken over by drug gangs. Now she runs a program for young people at risk in Baltimore called Rewired for Change. On the next Fresh Air, we'll talk about how her own life connects to The Wire and Rewired for Change. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Support comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wines, beers, and spirits for the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held on Saturdays from 3 to 6:30 p.m. in the Bouvon Wine Bar. More information is available at thecorkscrew.com.
This is Focus. It's our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics every week. On the program tomorrow morning, it's our regular day to be talking about money management. We do this every month. It's always on a Friday to give you the chance to ask questions about investing and financial planning. Our guest will be Kevin Waspy. He's a lecturer in the Department of Finance in the College of Business here at the U of I. Also, another topic that has to do with finances that we try to do about this time of year. We'll try to give you an opportunity to ask questions about taxes, federal and state taxes for 2011. We will have two guests, both from the firm of McGladrey and Pullen here in our area, John Breen and Marty Verdick. So whatever tax questions you have, that's tomorrow at 11. And then one more of a practical nature next week, Monday at 10. It's our monthly show on home maintenance. So again, we hope that we can help you solving some problems. Scott Spies will be here from the Spies Home Inspection Service. He knows a lot about the various pieces and parts of the single-family home. So if you got some problems, you can give us a call. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. Check the schedule by going to our website, which is will.illinois.edu. We're also on Twitter, Will Public Media. In this hour of Focus, our guest is Jane Desmond. She's professor of anthropology and affiliated faculty in gender and women's studies at the U of I. Among other things, she is interested in the subject we're talking about here, the field of human-animal studies. She has taught at Cornell, at Duke, at University of Iowa, and we're pleased to have her here with us this morning. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We do have some other callers, and our next is in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. Sure. This is a marvelous subject. I am also a person who has spent my life around horses, and I would say not only do they have a wide range of personalities, they also seem to engage in problem solving to a fairly sophisticated degree, as well as having very complex interpersonal relationships with themselves, with each other, and with humans. When we work with them, and rather than try to dominate them as the old training rules went,
right?
It's amazing how reciprocal the relationship can be between a horse and a person.
Thank you for that comment. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
My horses, for many years, have been Arabians, and of the old bloodlines that were in a living horse culture until, you know, around the First World War.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're very, very attuned to people. I've had my horses protect me from what they perceived as a threat. It was actually just another rider or a person that perhaps I didn't get along with. They're very protective. My old stallion had some health problems, and he liked to lie down a lot. And I could go into his stall and sit on him. Mm. And when he was ready for me to get up, he would make eye contact and gently nudge my leg and then watch me until I got clear of him and then get up.
Mm-hmm.
And this was something, you know, that just repeated itself over the course of his, you know, 26-year life. But he always, I figured if he was going to tell me that he wanted me to get up, I would oblige and not force the issue. And so he never, ever hurt me in that way. And a horse, of course, when a horse is down, that's when they are the most vulnerable.
Right.
So it's, you know, people would see me do that and say, you know, this is terribly foolish, which perhaps it was, but I trusted him and he trusted me.
Right.
And neither one of us abused that trust.
Thanks for that comment. Again, I'm not a person who has either done work on horse-human relations or had the opportunity to spend much time around horses, but I envy you that 26-year relationship. That's one thing that's so hard with the pets that are in our lives, is that oftentimes we don't get as long to share with them as we would like. But that notion of reciprocity and cooperativeness that you bring up, and the complexity of relationships, that's really something that I think as scholars and working with my own students, we are trying to get a grasp on and say, you know, we have quite a bit of knowledge about this from our lived experience. What if we were to, in a sense, take it seriously as a scholarly subject and say, well, how does this communication happen? How does this thing that we call trust, what's it based on? What's this mutuality? And as you mentioned in the changes in training, from what I have been reading, it's really have been intensely, very dramatic. No longer this notion, for some trainers at least, of, quote, breaking the horse, but rather of attaining a closeness through a whole series of choreographed steps. So thank you for bringing that up.
Okay. And one last thing. I have noticed in training that, and it was an old-time horseman who put me onto it, if you are going to be training a young horse, you put the horse in the pasture right next to where you are working an advanced horse, and one that they know. So I always like to work the mother or the sire, a horse that they know, and they actually do watch. They actually seem to learn. They're a lot easier to start than a horse that has never really been exposed to horses under saddle.
Right, right. That notion of the learned behaviors. And
right.
People have seen that even with the researchers working with certain apes who are learning languages, language-enabled apes, that if there's an infant or a young primate in the group and the mother, let's say, and a researcher are training on some symbols, then, in fact, that infant will pick up these symbol systems much more quickly than if they hadn't been exposed. So the learned behavior is certainly something that's very present and that we can start as a way of trying to understand them better.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. And we'll go on to, we have some other callers here next to someone in Champaign. This is line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a big, long experience of dogs, more than horses, but some horses. And I would like to comment, my daughter, since she was very small, seems to speak animal. Animals respond to her in a way that they don't respond to other people. Mm-hmm. And they are very, very distinguishing between those they like and the ones they don't.
Mm-hmm.
And I have watched her do things with horses that just had me shaking in my shoes.
Mm.
She speaks, and the horses are calm, collected.
Mm.
Okay, go ahead. And I've known three or four other people who have this ability to speak to animals,
mm-hmm.
not just an animal, but almost any animal they come in contact with. When they talk, the animal listens. I think that's a wonderful thing to have happen. And it does, to me, prove that we can, if we will, let the animals tell us. Not all animals. You have to be a bit judgmental, but that's my contribution for the morning.
All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Has there been any serious sort of scholarly attempt to look at those individuals, those humans, that seem to have that? Who knows what it is or how is it they're doing it? They certainly do seem to have an ability to communicate with other animals that's exceptional. That's way off the average.
Boy, this is great, because in some ways we're, you know, the fantasy for so many of us is, you know, the Dr. Doolittle fantasy.
Sure,
and that's
sure.
That's a childhood fantasy as well. I'm not at the moment aware of this type of research. It may well be going on out there in ethology or the sciences of animal behavior and so forth. That's one of the pleasures and the frustrations of really being part of a very interdisciplinary set of conversations, is that you're always humbled by what you can't know, but that makes you seek out people who might. So I don't want to say that no one's doing that work, not that I'm immediately aware of. However, that process of going from anecdotal evidence, you know, when we have scholarly conversations and then we have conversations around the dinner table, and we say, yeah, you know, there's this person and they just have what we would call a sixth sense. There are ways we could begin to uncover of what that consists. For instance, we know that many animals, even our own pets, are enormously attuned to nonverbal cues.
Mm.
If I put my shoes on and I pick up my purse, bam, she's at the door. Mom and the dog is ready to go out the door, because, you know, it might involve a ride in the car, which is how we have to refer to it in my house. So she is interpreting a great number of nonverbal cues. And I think for people who we would say colloquially seem to have a special gift with animals, they are giving a series of cues that indicate that they are attentive, that they're willing to try to establish some relational interaction, and that they're not imagining a relationship of domination.
Mm. That's very interesting. All right, let's talk with another caller here. This is also someone in Champaign. Line three. Hello.
Yeah, since this is Pledge Week on Will, you know, something that I, you know, remember with Bill Moyers, with Joseph Campbell.
Yes.
You know, in other words, the relationship. We've lost the relationship with the earth. We've lost the relationship with animals. And actually, fast forward today when we have feeding lots. Mm-hmm. You know, these animals are all, you know, packed in. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a factory approach. So I don't know, maybe your work will give us, you know, some enlightenment to people in this regard. So I don't know if you want to comment on that or not.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And, of course, the plug for Pledge Week is always useful. I want to recommend a book that's not a straight academic book. It's a widely published New York Times bestseller that you may have encountered and other listeners too, by Jonathan Safran Foer, called Eating Animals. He's the screenwriter of Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. So if you've just been watching that movie, he's the same fellow. And in it, he chronicles his own journey. Once he became a father, he had to struggle, as so many parents do, with the questions that his child asks, like, why do we eat the chicken and why don't we eat the dog in this country mainly, for instance. So he said, well, why do we eat the chicken and we don't eat the dog? And he wanted to find out then, with if he was serving his child chicken, he said, well, where'd that chicken come from? So that was his sort of personal journey into research, and the result is this book, Eating Animals, which led him to try to understand some of the horrific conditions that, in fact, do exist in CAFOs, or confined animal feeding operations, as they're called, where we've got tens of thousands of chickens, for instance, in battery cages. And I do think that's part of an industry which, when people learn about that, most people are not going to support about that. It's that it's invisible. So as that is made increasingly visible, then I think consumers are able to make a different choice if they wish. And I think that's what we saw happen in California recently with some of those propositions where now they are phasing out battery cages, which are cages about the size of an 8x11 sheet of paper, so that an animal, for instance, can't stretch its wings. They're phasing those out over the next 10 years, and that's a consumer-driven ethical choice that will have an impact on the industry, and the industry, of course, will respond. And I think that's one way in which we really are seeing some change, and it is driven by information.
Again, I want to thank the caller. We are coming to the point where we have maybe about 10 minutes, a little bit less, in this hour of focus with Jane Desmond. She's a professor of anthropology at University of Illinois, and we're talking about the emerging, not exactly recent emergence, but it's something that continues to develop on campuses like this, the field of human-animal studies, looking at the bond between humans and animals. How is it that we can come to understand animals and their experience, or can we, in fact, come to understand animals and their experience? And what does that mean for us? Looking at all of the various ways through a very long period of time that humans and animals have interacted, and animals have been very important to human culture. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You know, I think that one of the things that's happened in veterinary colleges like this one and ones in a lot of other places is that they are also thinking a lot more about the human-animal bond. Certainly, they're concerned with the health of animals, but they're also, I think, thinking a lot more about the relationship between people and their companion animals, the relationship between human beings and nature. They're really expanding beyond the health realm into a lot of other things. And one of the things that a lot of places are doing is that they have people who work in the area of helping people cope with the loss of a companion animal with the subject of grief. And that it's something that can be very deep and long-lasting. And I think only somebody who has lived with a companion animal and lost them knows this. Mm-hmm. I think there are some people who would say, oh, well, come on.
Get another one.
Yeah, exactly. And they might say, well, is that something do we really need grief counselors for people who lose their companions? Well, yeah, I think we actually do. And in many veterinary colleges, that's an area that they're moving into. Is that something that interests you, that is what that experience is about?
You know, that's one of the areas that I've written about, and I just have an article that's just come out called Animal Deaths and the Written Record of History. So I do want to address that. But first, let me put in a big shout out to the vet school here. I'm such a fan of the quality of this veterinary college that we have, and it was one of the things that drew me to this community. We've got ACES, we've got the vet school, and of course we've got the fabulous liberal arts and sciences. So it's a tremendous resource for the whole of the state. And as you say, veterinarians are really a huge link in all this. They're connecting us to the broader realm of health through what they're calling now One World, One Health, that if we don't take care of animal health, we cannot take care of human health. And another way, as you say, is the provision of pet loss hotlines. Not every vet school in the country has them, but we have an excellent one here. And some people may think that's silly. Say, what? You're going to call up someone and talk about that your cat died? Isn't that sort of, I don't know, mawkish or overly sentimental? But in fact, you know, going back to the statistics I shared in the beginning from the Argus Institute, that 57% would prefer their pet as their only companion on a desert island, says also 52% believe that their pets listen to them the best. So there are many special things about these relationships, in part the nonverbal communication and closeness that can develop. And what I find in my research is I wanted to ask, how do people mourn? We have a number of books now. If you go to a public library, you know, things like Losing Your Pet, you know, Your Child's First Experience with Death, and so forth. There's some help available in that way. But anyone who loses a pet has to encounter also a worker, you know, a colleague at work. And you say, oh, how are you doing? Well, we had our pet put to sleep last night. She was, you know, it was inoperable, or, you know, the struggle that they had gone through to make that decision with their veterinarian can be totally ignored. Say, well, you know, gee, that's too bad. Are you going to get another cat? It's like one sentence. Oh, that's too bad. Are you going to get another cat? As if, you know, they're just duplicable. And the thing I found is that people are very creative about this. They're making up ways to mourn because we don't have publicly recognized conventions. I've done some research on pet cemeteries, of which there are over 300 in this country, and they're part of a pet cemeterian organization. And when you visit these places, you find an outpouring of emotion and an improvisatory sensibility that's quite different than the formal relation we have with human cemeteries. For instance, you have poems written and left on a grave, or a dog's little chew toy, or one inscription I remember I saw says, "You mean rotten cat, we really miss you." So you couldn't say that. You couldn't put that on an inscription, you know, so-and-so was really lousy and, you know, we're glad you're gone, but we miss you anyway. We allow ourselves to express the unexpressible.
Yeah. You know, we're coming down to, we have maybe about 3-4 minutes. And I am, you know, being somebody who lives here in a university community, believe me, I'm down with the idea of discussing ideas for their own sake. But I'm also interested in how this kind of conversation we're having here gets out to the wider world, and how people who are not anthropologists think about animals and whether the attitudes are changing. And I can imagine, you know, having a conversation with somebody when you ask them a question, you know, do you think that people should take good care of their companion animals? And they'd say, well, of course. And do you think that we should protect wildlife? And they say, well, of course. And then you'd say, would you like to go for a burger? And they'd say, of course. Mm-hmm. Ah, now see, there's the rub. You know, where is the line here between the extreme personal, you know, how I behave, and the more general principle of saying, oh yeah, well, I think, you know, nature's good and let's take care of our animals. But I don't, there seems to be an inevitable progression here along that road, and yet that's I'm not sure that I'm ready to take that step, and there are a lot of other people that aren't ready to take that step either. You know, what's really the ultimate implication if we come down and say, well, really, what is the difference between us and the chicken and the cow? I'm not so sure. And if you're saying that, then okay, what do you do? How do you change your behavior? And are you going to say, oh, well, I guess that means no more fried chicken for me?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a very provocative question. And it's one that sometimes as we try to address the true moral complexities and challenges of, we find ourselves in language that's easy to dismiss. Okay. As we're thinking about these things, and I agree that we want to talk about ideas, but I also think that they inevitably move out into the world, whether through education or through discussions like this or through sustainable farming, sales at the farmer's market or whatever. I don't think we're going to find moral absolutes. We are going to find many communities that are grappling with the implications of the fact that we know more and the more and more we know about animals, the more and more complex they are, and hence the way it's incumbent upon us to think carefully about what we want that relationship to be. I want to mention a book I found very compelling by Matthew Scully, who, again, very readable. He was a Bush political speech writer, so he can write really persuasively. And it's his own journey through his self-described encounter with the Christian religion and the notion of dominion. In the end, he decides that the idea of dominion over animals is not really what was meant within the Christian philosophy. He sees it now as one of stewardship. For him, that meant he and his family decided to stop eating animals. That may not be the same thing for everyone. They might decide that they want to make a commitment to understanding what's required for the welfare of animals. We see this in small farming. I don't think there's a simple answer. I also think there's change over multiple generations. We've seen this now with the number of people who describe themselves as, say, flexitarians, that they don't eat meat on Monday. We're not going to have a radical change in a very short time, but I think we are seeing fundamental change over a long period of time.
Hmm. Well, I'm sure on other days, perhaps with other guests, we'll be coming back to some of these questions. But for right now, we'll have to say that's where we'll leave it, with our thanks to our guest, Jane Desmond. She's professor of anthropology here at the University of Illinois. Sometime in the future, there'll be a book from you?
Hopefully in the near future.
In the near future. All right. Thank you very kindly for being here.
Thanks so much, David.